Dr. William Luther Pierce. The year 2000. Lordy, lordy, payback time is near.
Hello. As you certainly must know by now, if you've listened to a few of my broadcasts, I'm not much of a Democrat by nature, and I regard the present political system in the United States as a disaster. It's a system in which we count the votes of millions of media-controlled lemmings to determine who our legislators will be and who the head of state will be. And everyone pretends that it's the will of the people which rules. The concept of the will of the people is questionable even under the best of conditions, where one has a reasonably homogeneous group of people with a high degree of commonality of interests. But in the multicultural chaos of the United States today, it is meaningless. It is an illusion which serves only to deceive and confuse. But it's easy enough to understand how this illusion is useful to the men who really run the country, the men who pull the strings. It's useful because when the voters become unhappy with the way things are going or the way the system is working, they have only themselves to blame. The string pullers are safely behind the scenes. There's no king to blame things on, no dictator, no oligarchs, or at least no visible oligarchs. The only thing the people see is the media circus with the commentators maintaining the suspense. Will the voters of New York go for Hillary or for Rick? Will the voters of Florida go for Al or for George W.? As if it made a lot of difference. Well, of course it does make a big difference to many of the voters. There are hundreds of thousands of Bush supporters, mostly the more upright and traditional Americans, who are horrified and frightened by the prospect of having a sidekick of Bill Clinton in the White House and continuing the Clinton era for another 4 years. And there are the assorted Bolsheviks, Hollywood trendies, welfare recipients, dykes, kikes, and the rest of the Clinton coalition who see Bush as the willing tool of fascist corporate bosses eager to grind the working class, and more important, the heroic liberal champions of the working class under their iron heels. The string pullers, of course, are not really worried because they know that either candidate will do what he is told to do. They will have to use somewhat different strategies depending upon which candidate wins, but no one is even permitted to become a serious candidate unless the string pullers are certain beforehand that he will take orders. You might conclude from what I've just said that the whole democratic process is so tightly controlled by the string pullers that it is completely meaningless and should be of no interest to us. Well, although that is substantially true, it is not completely true. Although the string pullers, the people who control the media, usually are able to make the electoral process go the way they want, nothing in life is absolutely certain. People miscalculate things. People make errors of judgment. Even very clever people sometimes trip themselves up by trying to be too clever. We can see an example of that in the recent presidential election. String pullers like close elections because that gives them a greater advantage. If one candidate is far ahead of the other in the polls, if he is beating his rival by 10-1, he doesn't really have to promise anyone anything. He knows that he'll win, and he doesn't need to beg anyone for support. Theoretically, he could even rebel against the string pullers and tell them to go to hell. That, in fact, is the Jew's worst nightmare. When a really popular leader arises in any country, a true man of the people, then the Jews have no leverage at all, and they usually find themselves in big trouble. Their survival depends upon playing a balancing game, upon keeping the population of a country sufficiently divided against itself so that the Jews have the balance of power and through their money and their media control can push an election either way. Don't be confused in this regard by the fact that the little Jews, with their natural Bolshevik tendencies, usually favor the Democrat by 4 or 5 or 6 to 1. They aren't the string pullers. It's the big Jews, the media bosses, and the money men who really control the candidates, and their aim always is to keep things sufficiently divided that they control both candidates, not just the Democrat. Balancing the candidates is not their only stratagem for controlling a democracy, of course. They also aim to divide the people in a very fundamental way, to divide the people culturally and biologically. That's one of the reasons they favor third world immigration and multiculturalism. That's why they're always pushing diversity. Although a diverse population may be more difficult to control in one sense, that is, it may be more difficult to keep a diverse population orderly and moving in the same direction, it is far less likely to combine against them. It is far less likely to combine behind a single candidate. They also strive to control the democratic process in depth, not just at the presidential level. Candidates typically come up through the system over a period of time. A presidential candidate typically has been a governor or a senator or a vice president before he becomes a presidential candidate. The string pullers have been able to test him and evaluate him over a period of time, to compromise and corrupt him, to be sure that he will take orders and will not surprise them or embarrass them. But balancing the candidates, keeping the elections reasonably close, is a part of their strategy of control, and they work at it just as they work at increasing the heterogeneity, the diversity of the electorate, and at making sure that no honest man gets very far into the system. But, as I noted, sometimes they outsmart themselves. In the recent presidential election, they kept Bush and Gore so close that we got the indecisive and really rather embarrassing result we have now. The media were taking polls every day during the last few weeks before the election and announcing breathlessly, Gore is ahead by 1 point. But then they would balance this by saying that they had a poll which showed that the people didn't trust Gore as much as they trusted Bush. And the next day they would announce, now Bush has pulled ahead by a point. When Bush got 3 or 4 points ahead, then a story about a long-ago drunk driving charge was given a big play to bring him back down closer to Gore. And so it went, right up to Election Day. And then we got the sort of result we have now, with the people in both major parties convinced that the other side is trying to steal the election. We have Jesse Jackson in Florida with his traveling circus organizing demonstrations. During the past 10 days, we have had the Jews in the Gore camp demanding recounts in several Florida counties. And we have had the Bush people in court demanding an end to the recounts. The media have been playing it up as proof that the system still works in America. In Pakistan or Brazil, under similar circumstances, the people would be rioting in the streets. But here we go by the rules. Isn't that wonderful? As a matter of fact, some of the demonstrations in Florida by Gore supporters this week have looked a lot like riots to me. More encouraging than that, however, is a huge amount of grassroots reaction to the election, as manifested on radio talk shows and in internet discussion groups. Paranoia is rampant. Never before have there been so many claims and such widespread belief in election fraud. While the media bosses are telling us that the election proves the system works, more people than I've ever seen before are saying that the election proves that the system is crooked. The really wonderful thing about this is that no matter whether Gore or Bush ends up in the White House, half the country will be convinced that the other side stole the election. That conviction will be good for the country, but it is not a conviction which will be helpful to the string pullers. For their racket to continue being successful, they need for the public to believe in the system and support the system. When most of the people no longer believe in the system, we will have a civil war. Civil wars are nasty things, destructive things, and most normal, healthy people abhor them. But a civil war is coming, and the sooner the better, because as the country becomes darker and more diverse, the other side becomes stronger. The longer we wait, the bloodier and more destructive the civil war will be, and the less chance we will have of winning it. That's why I say that the suspicion and discontent caused by the recent election are good for America and for our people, and they were not the consequences intended by the string pullers. I've received a lot of mail on this subject during the past week, and probably a letter from one Florida voter, Bob, sums them up. Bob writes, and I quote, "I have always been a voter, but this is the last time. I have been raped enough by these scoundrels in Washington. To hell with their elections. Let's start taking our country back now. I'm sick and tired of it all, and I won't take any more." End of quote. On the other side, we can see a mixture of gloating and whining in Jewish publications. A Jewish Telegraphic Agency dispatch of November 8th, for example, is headed, "Florida Jews may hold key to the presidency." The first line of the JTA dispatch reads, "In the end, the selection of the next president of the United States came down in many ways to voters in heavily Jewish South Florida." Actually, Jews make up only 5% of the population of Florida, but they are very heavily concentrated in a few Florida counties, and it is from those counties that most of the complaints about the election have come. After Bush won the popular vote in the state by only about 7,000 ballots, a recount was demanded. But in the most heavily Jewish counties, Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, one recount wasn't enough. They have been demanding recount after recount, and Bush's lead keeps dwindling. Jews in Palm Beach County, which is the most Jewish county in the United States, complained that they were confused by the ballot, and they want not only another recount, but a chance to vote all over again. Finally, there are the absentee ballots, all of which should have been counted by yesterday. An especially high percentage of Florida's absentee ballots come from Jews in Israel. Jews have demanded and received the privilege of being able to live in Israel as Israeli citizens and still retain all the rights of U.S. citizenship, such as being able to vote in U.S. elections. Virtually all of these Jewish dual citizenship votes are for Gore. The nicest possible outcome of the election would be for a few thousand Israelis to be the deciding element in putting Gore in the White House. Although Bush himself wouldn't dare to complain about that, plenty of Republican voters will be talking about it. As I said, the important thing about this election is not so much who won it, but that it has served to shake the faith of many voters in the system. One other good outcome of this election is the state of gridlock we can look forward to in the Congress, which is now much more evenly divided between the two parties. The less the Congress is able to agree on anything, the fewer new laws with which they will be able to saddle the American public. One issue, which certainly will be debated in the new Congress, is the issue of reparations to blacks for slavery. Just over a month ago, in my broadcast of October 14th, I pointed out that this issue, which has been sitting on the back burner for a long time, would begin heating up quickly, and it has. I made a wild guess in my October 14th broadcast that blacks might ask for as much as $1 trillion in reparations from whites, which would come to a little over $20,000 per white household in the United States. Well, since first sensing the possibility of squeezing some reparations money out of Whitey, Sambo has become more ambitious. Now spokesmen for the black reparations movement are talking about $5 trillion, or more than $100,000 per white household. And that's a wonderful thing. I suppose that a lot of timid, brainwashed, middle-class whites might be willing to cough up $20,000 in order to avoid being denounced as racists. But when somebody comes around to collect $100,000 from each of them instead, he's going to catch a 12-gauge rifle slug in the gut coming right through the door. That's another good reason for getting the guns away from all those white crackers now. Really, if there's any group of people in America who deserve to suffer, it's the white middle class. It's the people who have been warned for decades about where this country is headed, but who were too short-sighted, too timid, and above all, too greedy, too selfish to do anything about it. During the 1960s, when blacks were rioting and burning our cities, middle-class whites refused to take a strong stand against them because that would disrupt the country even more and would be bad for business. Instead, they tried to appease the blacks with all sorts of new civil rights laws and other government programs. They tried to buy them off. The whites just wanted to continue indulging themselves. They didn't want to do anything that might require a bit of austerity in return for the long-term improvement of the country. In the 1970s, when the real push was on to racially integrate the country through forced busing and forced housing and forced employment laws, and many white working-class people were demonstrating in the streets against this forced racial integration, the comfortable middle class, which was not being as adversely affected as the blue-collar class, refused to become involved. The white lawyers and doctors and accountants and professors and engineers and small businessmen just looked the other way and kept on stuffing their faces. Their kids weren't being bused to black schools. Their employment wasn't being threatened by affirmative action. They certainly weren't going to jeopardize their own comfort and security and respectability just because of what was happening to working-class white kids and working-class white parents. Of course, many middle-class whites were concerned about the degenerative trends which were all too obvious in America during the 1960s and 1970s. They just weren't concerned enough to do anything. Their solution was just to vote Republican and keep making as much money as possible so that they could insulate themselves and their own immediate families from what was happening around them, and to hell with everyone else. And so we had the Reagan era, and the white middle class thought that their strategy of compromise and appeasement and selfishness had worked. Well, of course, it hadn't worked. Such strategies never work in the long run. People who will not fight eventually will be eaten by people who will fight. A community whose members are so self-centered that they will work only for their own personal benefit and not for the common good eventually will be destroyed by its enemies. And our enemies have been at work day and night. They opened our borders to the subhumanity of the third world and began building up their numbers. They encouraged feminism and began reducing our numbers by persuading our women that careers were more important than families. They infiltrated and took over our educational establishment and taught our children that they should be ashamed of their own race, that their own history and traditions weren't worth learning about. And the children of the white middle class learned instead that doing drugs and putting safety pins through their noses and wearing baseball caps backward and listening to black rappers is cool. And the daughters of the white middle class began bedding down with blacks and becoming pregnant with mongrel babies, and their parents didn't like it, but they tolerated it as long as they could hang on to their money and their comfort and their lifestyle. And eventually, the enemies of our people were strong enough to launch the Clinton era. But the members of the white middle class were still comfortable, and so they tolerated the Clinton era too, with all of its treason and degeneracy. They tolerated the total Judaization of their government. They tolerated the Clinton government's bombing of Belgrade to force Serbia into line with the New World Order. They didn't like it, but they tolerated it. And so now the fruits of all that toleration are almost ready to be harvested. And it's about time. It's about time for the white middle class to have to deal with the problem of 30 million blacks who believe they are entitled to reparations and who very shortly will be clamoring for $100,000 from every white family. They believe they're entitled to at least $5 trillion in reparations from us because we tolerated the Jewish media pumping expectations of that sort into them during the past 50 years. We tolerated all of the Hollywood films and the television propaganda telling them about how they were persecuted and mistreated by us for 400 years and that they really are equal to us, and the only thing which has kept them from achieving what we have achieved is white racism. We knew it wasn't true. We knew it was Jewish lies. But we tolerated that propaganda rather than risk being called racists for contradicting it or anti-Semites for pointing out who the liars were. And we also proved to 30 million blacks that we're a bunch of wimps who won't fight for our people or for our own rights. They believe that the white man owes them $5 trillion and that he doesn't have the guts or the gumption to stop them from taking it. It'll be an interesting fight. And you know what? I'll be cheering for the folks demanding reparations. I think it's about time for the soft, white, middle class to begin facing reality and to experience a bit of trauma and privation. Perhaps it'll help a few of them learn how to survive in the jungle from which they have been too far removed for too long. Thanks for being with me again today.